We're talking to George Packer, who is probably modern-day George Orwell, certainly in essay terms. You were provoked by COVID to write your latest book. You are doing an Orwell and drawing tribes that we see today in America, which you talk about. I want to focus, please, on the crisis and on the renewal. Not everyone is in a tribe. So, George Packer, as an Orwellian essayist, what does a reader who is not in a tribe take from your book?
Well, thank you for the comparison, which I firmly reject, but I'm also very grateful for, because Orwell is my hero, as you know. I think of these four Americas in Last Best Hope as narratives more than tribes. They're ideas about what America is, what America should be. So it's not as though you're either a member or you're not. They offer something to different people. And I think each of us might feel some kinship for each of the four. Free America, which is Reagan's America, which is the America of getting government out of your life so that you can go as far as your talents take you. That's the best version of it. There's also a dark version. Smart America, which is the meritocracy, the professional class. Real America, which is Sarah Palin and Donald Trump's America of the heartland. And Just America, which is a new generation of Americans who are in the streets for social justice. Each of those has a positive value, and I think each of them also has some negative qualities. My feeling is all of them have failed us in the sense that they haven't created a narrative that all of us or most Americans can feel included in and motivated by to make our society better. And so when I think of the four Americas, I think of ideas of America in competition with each other, which are always changing and are always affecting each other and in some ways morphing into each other, which means they're more fluid than tribes and give us more room to work with them in order to try to find one that actually can be a success, which I call Equal America.
Walt Whitman, Walter Lippmann, Alexis de Tocqueville. De Tocqueville is incredibly important. Yes. Why are the ideas of these writers so important in your own work, in your own analysis of crisis and renewal?
Well, you're absolutely right to have seen that, Claudia. I was reading American history and American thought during COVID and trying to think what would be the right book to write for our own moment that's in the tradition of those earlier writers who analyzed their time, but also in terms of universal ideas and ideals. Tocqueville saw that the most distinctive thing about Americans is what he called the passion for equality. Coming from Europe, from an aristocratic world, the feeling of wanting to be equal to everyone else and have access to everything everyone else had access to was the most striking feature of Americans. That doesn't mean we are equal. We have never been equal. And in Tocqueville's time, there was slavery. But the passion for equality as a kind of motivating force that drives people to change both their lives and the life of their society has never gone away. And so Tocqueville saw this quality that I think is still at the heart of our society. And when it's denied, it creates division and social conflict and tribalism of the kind we see now. And the other thing in Tocqueville that I found quite important was what he calls the art of self-government, the skills and talents needed in order to run our own affairs, which are not natural and are not obvious and can be lost. So Tocqueville and Whitman, who of course was the great poet of equality, and Lippmann, who was the great essayist of self-government, were the real influences on me when I was writing Last Best Hope.
Well, what's interesting about de Tocqueville is that he said the thing that struck him most about Americans was their passion for equality, George. But he didn't necessarily mean economic equality. Your tribes are divided by their economic status and their economic opportunity.
Yeah, you're right. When Tocqueville talked about equality, he meant something almost spiritual, a sense of equal worth, equal dignity, equal status. But I think we would also call it equal opportunity. The chance to be anything and to do anything and to go anywhere. It does not mean equality of results. And that means it does not mean absolute economic equality. So Tocqueville did not mean economic equality and equality of results, but he did notice that when equality was taken to its extreme, which is individualism, extreme individualism, it leads to inequality because we feel no obligation to one another and we hoard our own goods and live for ourselves and our immediate family. And so inequality, economic inequality, can result from this equality of social status that Tocqueville saw. He called it the industrial aristocracy. So he did foresee real economic inequality as a threat to democracy. And today, of course, we're living with a post-industrial aristocracy. Its name is Jeff Bezos. Its name is Mark Zuckerberg. Its name is Google and Twitter and Facebook and all kinds of other monopolies. And so if equality of result becomes too, if inequality of result becomes too broad, equal opportunity is a lie. In other words, you can't let outcomes and conditions become so unequal that real equal opportunity is impossible for large numbers of people. And that's what we have today, which is why we can't ignore economic inequality, even though Tocqueville, you're right, was talking about something a bit different.
I'd like to remind our listeners that you are a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist for The Assassin's Gate and for 2019 biography of Richard Holbrooke. You are a very solid writer for The Atlantic, for The New Yorker, and your own work. And do you think, George Packer, that America understands class struggle now, or are we in a situation where all the tribes you describe, in fact, ignore class struggle because they all believe they're going to be on the top tier in some sort of Walter Mitty way?
Well, as an English woman living in America, you know that class is a concept Americans have a very hard time seeing and accepting because we believe that there is so much social mobility, so much opportunity, that class is an illusion. You may be born into a certain level, but you're not going to end up there. That was a myth that Americans lived with for hundreds of years. I think it's dying. I think we are now so class-ridden, so hierarchical, and it's not just by income, it's by education. That is a crucial dividing line in our society, that Americans feel that they are trapped in the circumstances of their birth, maybe more than at any other time in our history, or maybe more Americans feel that way. It's been true for Black Americans for a very long time. It's only recently that opportunities have become more widespread, but for the broad majority of the country, the feeling that that you will not do better than your parents, and in fact, you'll probably do worse, and that the opportunities that you were told would be yours are not going to be there. That's a very strong feeling, and it's based in data. Social mobility here is much lower now than it is in a lot of European countries. So class is a reality that Americans are getting familiar with. And I think that sense of resentment and of anger that class inequality breeds, including when it's based on education, is behind a lot of the division that are in the four Americas I describe, and a lot of the political vitriol that infects the body politic today. So I think class is the heart of the problem. And if we could focus on it as the heart of the problem, rather than be distracted by the culture wars, then I think we could begin to solve some basic problems, including the problem of self-government.
But some on the left are really, really peed off with your book. They argue that it's a misunderstanding, that basically does nothing to serve the purposes. But you haven't written a polemic after all. You've just written essays and a survey of the situation as you see it. What would you say to those on the left who find your book perhaps unhelpful? What would you have them understand?
First, I'd urge them to read the book, and when they do, they'll see that a good part of the book is a passionate call for greater equality and for how we can get there, and for working Americans, Americans below the professional classes, to be given more power, more of a voice in our economy and in our politics, and for monopolies to be broken up. That's the program of the book, and it's a left-wing program. I'm critical of some of the doctrinaire and illiberal tendencies on the left that I see around me in media, in academia, and in politics, which have decided these are the answers, this is the terminology, and anyone who strays is likely to pay a high price for it. That's not a way that you arrive at the right answers, or at a broad-based political coalition, or at a society that I want to live in. So I am critical of that. I'm not going to apologize for it, but I would urge people on the left to read the book before they decide they don't like my ideas.
You are rightly critical of the Fourth Estate as it is now, and the new additions to the Fourth Estate, such as social media, Twitter, various forms. So what is to be done? Are we to go back to the old-fashioned methods of journalism, as I was taught in newsrooms with senior editors, old heads on young shoulders, and you're brought up, as you must have had, George Packer, at The New Yorker when you started out? What is your prescriptive for dealing with journalism?
I mean, partly it's just about self-restraint. Get off Twitter. Try not to spend too many hours a day reading what's said about you and saying things about other people that are essentially mutual back scratching or back biting. That's what so much of journalism amounts to today. And I, for the life of me, don't understand what contribution it's making or what legacy it's going to leave. And once you've gotten off Twitter, remember how to be a reporter and go out and talk to people who are not like you, and who are not in the media, and whose experience may be a little hard to understand, whose point of view may even be alien to you, but need to be understood because they're part of our society. But then we have to put in place incentives for journalists to do that. We need incentives that restore local news, that restore reporting as the heart of journalism, because obviously social media and opinion journalism have risen in a vacuum created by the destruction of the financial base of journalism, by the internet, and by monopoly corporations. I don't have all the answers to how you change the incentives, but we really do need a media that provide news, and local news above all, to Americans who are now swimming in seas of lies that are encased, you know, within each in its own bubble, and that can't see or understand or hear anyone outside that.
Isn't it true, George Packer, that we actually have two tribes? I mean, that is the problem. We have excess of 70 million voting for that man, and 70 million voting probably for President Biden and Kamala Harris personally. But what is to be done to coalesce the four tribes into the actual two so that it is more effective?
I agree we have two tribes. We are red and blue. The divisions are profound. They're semi-permanent. Every election reinforces them. They come out at elections more than at any other time. That's why I distinguish between tribes and narratives. I think narratives divide each tribe, each on its own side. The left is divided, or I should say maybe Democrats, liberals are divided almost generationally between smart and just America. Republicans are divided ideologically and to some extent generationally between free and real America. So the narratives divide each side. And we see that more between elections. But when there's an election, they coalesce because there's a binary choice. And that coalescence becomes a cold civil war. Each tribe, red and blue, sees the other as an existential threat to everything that they think this country stands for. How do we begin to overcome that? I think we go back to equality, Claudia. If we can begin to use government and show government being used to improve material conditions for all of these groups, the temperature might go down. We will not abandon our hostile postures and our dearly held values, but we might lower the temperature and detoxify the rhetoric a bit so that we can begin to see each other as fellow citizens again, because without equality, there is no sense of shared citizenship.
Indeed. And as you look for ideas and policies to redress the division, what part, George Packer, do race and global awareness play? Because in your tribes, it's perfectly clear that the technocrats, they are predominantly foreign-born, most of them.
Well, I think the smart America is made up of a lot of different people. Some are immigrants, some are white Americans. There are some black and brown Americans. It depends on education and profession. But you're right that immigrants seem to be bringing the energy and even the faith in the American project that native-born Americans are losing. And so, in a way, to close the door to immigrants means we're going to seal ourselves off in an increasingly disbelieving, skeptical, and disillusioned America. So that for me, it's like oxygen. We need immigrants because they revitalize our faith in our own project. I also think that if we think about class as much as we think about race, and think about a transracial working class whose voting patterns and values continually defy media expectations, we will get closer to seeing what policies might actually begin to solve problems and to close down divisions. But as long as we imagine that people think and vote and exist according to the identity groups that they've been assigned, generally by political and media elites, it's going to open the divisions up more, and it's not going to create the kind of politics that we need in order to bring about justice.
Bayard Rustin. Tell me about him and actually your epilogue, which is the most heartening part of your book. Tell me about Bayard Rustin.
He's not as well known as he should be. He was a great civil rights hero. He was a Christian, a socialist, a pacifist, and gay, as well as black. So he had, by the lights of mainstream America, a lot of counts against him. He was also just a man of tremendous intellect and courage and dignity. He was Martin Luther King's strategic advisor for many years and really was the one who brought the ideas of Gandhi and nonviolence to the civil rights movement and gave it life in direct action. So he was hugely important, but because he was gay, whenever his profile got too high, someone would use him to blackmail King, and King would have to distance himself from Rustin, which Rustin was deeply hurt by. He was the one who organized the March on Washington in 1963, which was maybe the greatest moment of of those years of civil rights. But he also was very farsighted in seeing at what point the civil rights movement had to leave the streets or at least develop a new strategy that was not just protest, but was coalition politics in order, once it changed our laws, it would need politics to change material conditions to get us closer to equality. And so he saw that the civil rights movement had to become a political force that was in coalition with labor, with liberals, with all kinds of people who may or may not have been in the marches of the early 60s. To me, he was one of the great heroes of American history, and I wish his name were better known.
Other key individuals in the coalition you talk about, tell me.
Well, there are three Americans I write about toward the end of the book as sort of inspiring figures who we should look to for ways of living and acting that bring us closer to the idea of equality. The first is Horace Greeley, a journalist, probably the most important journalist of most of the 19th century, who was a passionate anti-slavery crusader and knew Lincoln and in some ways did his best to bring about the Civil War by calling attention to the evil of slavery in Kansas and around the country. He was also kind of a tribune of the working class. His paper was called the New York Tribune, and it was read by working people around the country. So he was sort of, he showed the divisions that I write about between smart and real and just and free America did not exist back then. He moved between all of those. He belonged to all of them. And really, his overarching passion was for equal America. And then there's Frances Perkins, the first woman cabinet member in American history, Roosevelt's labor secretary during the New Deal, who was a social worker who then entered government because she saw that great change, structural change, required working with even corrupt machine politicians to get things done. She wasn't so rigid about what was right and wrong that she refused to get her hands dirty in politics. She also just had so many ideas. Half the New Deal was her idea before Roosevelt took office. And so she too, like Rustin, like Greeley, I wish were better known. Her obscurity, relative obscurity, is partly due to her being a woman. She took the back seat to Roosevelt and the men in the New Deal, but Frances Perkins, other than Franklin Roosevelt, I think was the main force of the New Deal.
Isn't the problem perhaps where children are brought up in America to believe they can be anything and do anything, that in fact Biden's attempt at the New Deal does not go far enough in trying to rebalance this multi-everything democracy?
I think Biden has the right idea. He's pointed us in the right direction. He has ambitious plans for how much government intervention in our economy could actually help bring people up from the misery class and from the working class back into the middle class, which used to be strong and is now weak. But you're right that there are sort of intellectual limits that the Democratic Party has brought with it because it's been, I think, stuck in a neoliberal rut for decades. And there's also political limits, which come with being a 50-50 Congress and with replete with ancient roadblocks to getting anything done that are now exploited and abused by the Republicans, who are really a party that seeks power for its own sake, even as a minority party. So Biden has so much headwind against him, but I'm encouraged, I'm hopeful. And if you noted hope in my last pages, it's because I do think we are beginning to see the direction we have to go in, even if we can't get there as quickly as we need to.
How do you persuade people who read your book, people who listen to this conversation, that it is the leave me alone aspect of their personalities and their failure to engage that is a real problem in making change?
We have a really narrow idea of what freedom means. And it's the idea that comes from Reagan and Free America, which is don't tread on me. I am in charge of myself. You can't tell me what to do. The government can't tell me to wear a mask. It can't tell me that it needs regulations in order to keep it, workers safe. And that idea of freedom is negative freedom, freedom from. But Tocqueville wrote about positive freedom, freedom to the free institutions that are necessary for us to govern ourselves. We don't govern ourselves simply by leaving each other alone. We govern ourselves by learning how to work together in institutions, whether it's government or journalism or others, by listening and by debating and arguing and even trying to persuade. And that freedom, positive freedom, the freedom to have a say, to participate in the economy and in politics, is to me a more, I would say, a more grown-up idea. It's more responsible. It's a freedom that that comes with obligations as well as with rights and opportunities. And the result of negative freedom is all around us. A society in which we can't even agree that a mask might save people's lives, including your own, and therefore it's something that you should wear regardless of whether the government tells you to. Instead, the mask became the symbol of our tribal divisions, exploited by he who shall not be named. I think we need a new idea of freedom, an idea that encompasses self-government, which doesn't come automatically, and which suffers when we neglect it because we're each pursuing our own separate destinies, free of the interference of everyone else.
But it seems that in order to somehow redress the economic inequality, the racial disparity has to be addressed fundamentally and with really a big stick. So if it's not reparations, as an essayist, as an analyst, what would you see people, but Bayard Rustin types, able to do very fundamentally in a one, two, three sort of way? We have to do this, that, and that.
Well, look, reparations should be on the table. Reparations, just as a matter of simple justice, seem to me increasingly evident as a necessary part of any program. But reparations is different from guaranteeing equal outcomes. If we look at outcomes across racial and ethnic groups as the measure of whether we are achieving greater equality, I think it leads to some perverse policies. I mean, one of them was when the CDC back in, I think, December decided it would distribute vaccines as a priority to essential workers rather than to older people, because essential workers are overrepresented by Black Americans and Brown Americans, and older people are underrepresented. Well, that made no sense. You're giving the vaccine to a 23-year-old Uber driver ahead of an 80-year-old Social Security recipient who's much likelier to get sick and die. So, equity and looking at disparate racial outcomes can lead to perverse solutions, including the idea of getting rid of standardized tests because they show an achievement gap, a stubborn achievement gap. I'm more a supporter of universal programs that target the disadvantaged, the oppressed, the poor, no matter who they are, rather than dividing that group further into subgroups and then targeting those subgroups at the expense of other subgroups who are inevitably going to feel left out and even resentful. That's my general feeling about what you're asking. As for a one, two, three, I'm not smart enough to have a one, two, three, but I bet some very good policy analysts out there who know more than I do about policy can propose ways to rebuild the safety net, to increase the economic power of workers as well as their wages. It's beginning to happen by economic forces already. And to give workers a stronger voice in the running of the enterprises that they make a success by with labor unions, sectoral bargaining, and other means. So those are the not my ideas, other people's ideas, but good ones for, in general, reorienting the whole balance of economic and political power away from the top of our society and toward the broad mass of working people.
And it's clear that the Biden-Harris administration has policies on the table they're trying to push through. And if they can get past the Senate and if we can get rid of the filibuster, we might actually see them happening. But apart from the economic policies, George Packer, there is the social fabric, which is fundamentally broken. You wrote about this in The Unwinding and in A History of New America. You won the National Book Award for that in 2013. How can everybody take part in making a contribution to mend it?
Yeah, I think that Last Best Hope is something of a sequel to The Unwinding, and a commentary on The Unwinding. The Unwinding was a narrative based on a lot of reporting. Last Best Hope, which, as you said, is a COVID book, is an essay about some of the phenomena that I reported on in The Unwinding. I would say, in a word, things have gotten worse. I saw the loneliness, the isolation, the cynicism about institutions, the distrust of elites, all of that in The Unwinding. I did not, and I saw a landscape that could produce someone like Trump. I didn't see Trump himself. I didn't see just how fragile democracy was and how easily it could be overthrown. And I didn't see the effect of disinformation on masses of ordinary people. So the very fabric of reality became a matter that we couldn't have a basic agreement about, the very nature of facts. Without that, everything else is impossible in a democracy, and that's where we are. If we have fundamental disagreements about facts, we can't even begin to discuss solutions. So I think while the unwinding focused on inequality a great deal, as does Last Best Hope, I think we also have to focus on rebuilding our institutions and re-knitting the social fabric. And there are ways, there are policies, they don't seem adequate, but they're a beginning. National service is one. Getting Americans from every background working together for a year as young people on some public service project. Why not do that? It seems like such an obvious way to break down some of the tribal divides. Civics education as a universal American requirement, but that doesn't impose one interpretation on American history, but rather teaches children how to think about American history and about our institutions and what it means to be a citizen. And then something we talked about earlier, Claudia, getting journalists to rediscover the vocation of journalism and stop being brand builders, which seems like a pointless waste of everybody's time. And that means changing the incentives so that we have a rebirth of local news and a crushing of Twitter news, which is where most people now live. So those are my puny little ideas for how we can restore to some degree the social fabric and the institutions that are the pillars of self-government.
You talk about the events of January the 6th being a series of catastrophes that meant America dodged more than a bullet. It dodged a mortar round. George Packer, that bullet, that ammunition is still live. When people say that the loony left, the liberal left are unpatriotic, and the counter to that is these big trucks with people in fatigues and guns quite often, what is to be done about that?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, don't let them seize the word patriotism and claim it for their own. There was a left patriotism in this country. I would say Horace Greeley, Francis Perkins, and Bayard Rustin all embodied it. Franklin Roosevelt gave it a great national idea, the New Deal, a new role for government. That was patriotic in those days. Langston Hughes, a communist member, I don't know if he's a member, but he was certainly sympathetic to the Communist Party, wrote a great poem, Let America Be America Again, in the middle of the Depression. So first of all, don't let patriotism be stolen by the sunshine patriots who wave their flags and then storm the Capitol and try to destroy the very democracy that's at the heart of the American idea. But the other thing is you can't reason with some people. You have to make sure that they are under scrutiny and are being prosecuted if they've broken the law and are being shamed and isolated in their lunatic ideas. I mean, I'm not a believer in all of us sitting down and agreeing that we can all get along as Americans, because some of us obviously cannot. And those Americans have to be, the rest of us have to make it clear that there's certain ground rules without which we cannot function. One of them is facts, and another is respecting democratic norms, including election results. And that has to be reiterated again and again in the face of relentless opposition. The Republican Party won't even allow Congress to set up a commission to investigate exactly why there was a near insurrection on January 6th.
Mercifully, Speaker Pelosi has perfectly clearly taken control of it all, and there will be an investigation. So it's not just the economics that's bust. It's not just the social fabric is bust. It's actually the morality. Do you believe that morality in 2021 is an undervalued part of political life?
I'm all for it. I'm all for that analysis, because I think in a way, democracy requires us to behave ourselves. It requires good conduct. Without it, if the ordinary people decide the hell with it, we can act and say and do whatever we want. Then we, first of all, we abandon the field to people at the top who have power on their mind. And also we simply allow the levers, the tools to go unused. And so, yeah, virtue is actually a requirement of democracy. But I also think virtue depends on a sense of equal worth. If you feel that you are devalued, that you don't count, that your people are despised, are second class, and if your whole life is devoted to simply surviving from day to day, it's very hard to expect that you're going to be the virtuous citizen that democracy actually needs you to be. So I do think that economic conditions and morality have a thread that connects them. But I agree with you, Claudia, that we have to remember, and Trump was a daily reminder, that decency and honesty and respect and civility and all those old-fashioned virtues that may make people a bit cynical today are absolutely necessary to self-government working.
We talked about the prompt for this book being COVID. Do you believe, as many of us hope, that COVID actually could be a force for change for the good? Are you seeing evidence of that now, or do you believe the political divisions are more entrenched than ever?
Well, at the beginning of the pandemic, I hoped that the fact that it had a universal target, human beings, would remind us of what we have in common. Instead, it drove us apart. It made us afraid. It made us angry. It had the effect that actually plagues usually do have in history. Right now, I think two things are happening. One is we have seen the divisions. We have seen the inequalities in their most vivid display during COVID. And we shouldn't and might not forget that. And I think that memory is driving a good deal of the thinking of the Democratic Party and the Biden administration for the good. At the same time, we all just want to get back to life and to living as we used to and as we want to. And so there's a kind of jazz age, gaudy spree ahead of us for those who are lucky enough to be able to enjoy it, that might distract us from what was a pretty frightening picture in the mirror of how America looked last year. I don't want to forget that face in the mirror. I want it to be there in front of us, even if we're enjoying ourselves, so that we remember what a pandemic did to us, how low it brought us, and will again, or something else will, because we have not solved the problems that it exposed. And if we can keep that in mind, then I think we might be moving in a better direction than we've been in for the last 20 or 30 years.
Well, you are our last best hope, George Packer, whose new book, Last Best Hope, is a shrewd analysis of America's ruptures. We really appreciate you speaking today to KGNU Denver, Boulder, Fort Collins.
I very much enjoyed it. Thanks, Claudia.